Before I even start and introduce my talk, let me tell you what spin form models means. So don't be scared by a fancy name. It's something which you, or at least which people, study for a long time. Basically, spin form models are simplicial state sum models. And if you don't remember what simplicial state sum models are, I'll give you two examples here. Examples are Migdal-Witten model of 2D Jan-Mills and Puraev-Virov model of 3D TKFT. So spin form models is really just a fancy name for something people study for a long time. I want to say that results I'm talking here, they not all results belong to myself. There is a large number of people working in this field, and I'll be using results of everybody. What is mine here is point of view. And I tried, so you will see it's a very special point of view. I tried to make it very much for string audience. Spin form models are intimately related to loop quantum gravity. And we heard talk on Tuesday by Carlo Rovelli, where he introduced spin form models as a way to understand and encode dynamics of quantum, of loop quantum gravity. However, I'll take completely different route to spin form models. Basically, I will not mention loop quantum gravity at all. And the reason why I did that, first of all, I wanted to make it, as I said, tailored to string audience. I wanted to use language of string audience. And, the route I'll follow is 2 plus 1 gravity and TQFT. As a motivation, I'll take this. The logic of my talk will be very simple. What I'll try to do, I'll try to generalize to higher dimensions what works in 2 plus 1 gravity. So, because of that, I have to explain you what is 2 plus 1 and what I mean by works. And because of that, I'll be a large chunk of my talk will be about 2 plus 1 gravity. Before I tell you about 2 plus 1 gravity, let me make a remark. 2 plus 1 gravity is important on its own, because I think we don't completely understand 2 plus 1, even by now. Everybody believes that 2 plus 1 can be quantized, because its system is finite number of degrees of freedom, but there are questions which are unanswered. For example, the question of bulk boundary correspondence and the question of quantum origin of central charge. I will not be talking about that, but I think 2 plus 1 is important on its own. I'll be using different results from 2 plus 1, not the ones which would be related to negative cosmological constant, but still, it's something interesting on its own. So quickly, a reminder of 2 plus 1 gravity. So the action is simply E wedge F, where E is the frame field or triad field, and F is the curvature of connection. You can see that it's just BF theory for the group SO3. By BF theory, it's just B times F. Equations of motion which follow from here. It's just E is currently constant with respect to connection, and F is equal to zero. This equation tells you that spin connection, the connection on which the action depends, is the spin connection determined by the frame, and then this equation is just a statement of Einstein equations in 2 plus 1. As you all know, this equation may mean that there are no local degrees of freedom. Basically, if you consider gravity on the manifold of topology sigma cos R and sigma is compact, you will find that the phase space is finite dimensional. I'll say more about that later. You can easily introduce cosmological constant. It's just EF plus the volume term, which is cubic in ease. Okay, now let me go to a quick discussion of quantizations of 2 plus 1. So there are different ways to quantize it. First is canonical, historically the first and probably the easiest one. So as I said, you can show that if you do canonical space plus time decomposition, you can see that the phase space is finite dimensional. For example, I think if genus of your sigma of compact space is, say, G, then phase space will be like 12G minus 12 dimensional. Anyway, it's finite dimensional space. It makes it easier to quantize it. And that's what Witten did in his original work. So this is all good, but this way probably cannot be generalized to higher dimensions, because the structure of phase space in higher dimensions is much more complicated. We don't understand they reduce phase space completely. However, there is approach which is approach of canonical quantization of gravity, which does not reduce phase space, and starts by quantization of full phase space, then tries to quantize constraints and impose them at the quantum level. This is loop quantum gravity approach, and I will not follow this approach here, so I'll be doing something else. There is path integral definition. There is path integral quantization of 2 plus 1. And by path integral here, I mean perturbative definition. So if you just look at the action, you see that there at the action in the first order formalism, it's important to take first order formalism. You will see that there is a kinetic term, and there is a term which you can interpret if you want to do usual perturbation theory. There is a term which you can interpret as kinetic term. And there are two interaction terms. In the case of lambda is equal to zero, there is just one interaction term, which is just E, which omega, cubic interaction. You can take that theory defined by this and treat it as usual perturbative theory. You can do expansion around E and omega is equal to zero. And you find that theory is perfectly well defined. It turns out that this one, without cosmological constant, is even one loop exact. So it's finite theory. There are no problems with it. There is one important lesson which we learned here. And I want to emphasize this. You all know that if you do perturbative expansion in 2 plus 1 near flat metric, if you start from usual Einstein-Hilbert action, take flat metric and do usual perturbative expansion around flat metric, the theory doesn't perturbative theory doesn't make sense. It's non-renormalizable. However, you see, if you do this, this tells you that because this one around E omega is equal to zero vacuum is a good theory. It tells you just that the vacuum of flat metric is not a good vacuum to start with. It's not a good vacuum to expand around. You can also make sense of this theory using Chern-Simons perturbation theory, which is, you just define again, you cast this BF theory into Chern-Simons theory and then use Chern-Simons perturbation theory. Again, it gives you definition, perturbative definition of path integral. There is a problem with this definition. It's impossible to generalize it to higher dimensions, because if you try to do the same trick, if you take action in the first order formalism, it will look like, it will no longer look like E which F. It will be something more complicated. It will be E which E dual which F and trace. If you try to expand this action around E and omega is equal to zero, there will be no quadratic term, no kinetic term, which means that just perturbation theory doesn't make sense. It doesn't know what to do. It's not the theory which can be treated perturbatively. This doesn't mean, however, that perturbation theory fails or something like that. It just doesn't know what to do with it. It's not the action. There is no kinetic term. And so this perturbative definition cannot be generalized to higher dimensions.
What you would call the wrong thing and mm-hmm. expand around the flat metric, and mm-hmm. actually perturbation theory does make sense mm-hmm. in this finite.
Does make sense?
And it's finite, yeah.
Yes.
In 2 plus 1. If you look carefully.
It's cloud counting bad.
Okay. What I'll be trying to convince you in is that there exists another definition of path integral, non-perturbative definition. And it's the one given by Panzano Reggi or Tugai-Viro models, and I'll tell you how to generalize that definition to higher dimensions, and I'll show you that something makes sense. So basically, my main point will be to try to convince you that in 2 plus 1 there is non-perturbative definition of path integral, which I then take to higher dimensions. So, and probably you don't believe that, because I wouldn't believe that. Let me tell you what Panzano Reggi Tugai-Viro models are. So these are state sum models, simplicial state sum models. So what you do, you chop space-time into tetrahedra. Then you label every tetrahedron, you give it, assign some amplitude. Then you take a product of amplitudes for every tetrahedron. And yeah, tetrahedra are labeled ones, you sum over labelings. But the main point is that you take a product of amplitudes for tetrahedra, and then you call the result history amplitude. And I'll tell you what the interpretation of this history amplitude is. But it's some number which you assign to triangulation. So So let's be more precise. Let's see what kind of amplitudes there are. So in Panzano-Reggi model, you chop space-time into tetrahedra, then you assign to every edge of triangulation spin. Then from these spins you form object, the so-called classical normalized CJ symbol, which is a very natural object in representation theory. It rises to tensor product. If you study tensor products of representation, that basically, that's a very natural number there. Then you take a product over tetrahedra of these CJ symbols. You take a product over edges of dimensions of those representations. Then you sum over all labelings, and that's what you call history amplitude. After subtleties, this history amplitude turns out to be triangulation independent, which means that you can interpret this history amplitude not as amplitude of triangulation, but as amplitude of the whole space-time, which you started from. And I'll be talking more about that. What are subtleties here? Subtlety is that this guy diverges because the sums are here. The sums of the spins here are infinite. And this divergence is very, I would say, it's very mild divergence. It's completely understood where it comes from, and there is a very natural way to regularize it. So the way to, one of the ways to regularize it is given by Tourailles-Viron model, which works with quantum groups. So you work with SU2 at level K, and then representations run from, they're bounded from above. And it turns out that this Tourailles-Viron model, where all objects here become those of quantum group, it is related to gravity with cosmological constant. And I'll mention how you can see that. It turns out that this deformation level is related to cosmological constant, if you have gravity with cosmological constant.
If the cosmological constant is zero, all this amplitude
is zero? Yes. There's also understanding of that, where it comes from. So amplitudes, because CJ symbols are real, all amplitudes will be real.
What geometrical quantity J
could be? I don't want to say that yet. It's a model. Okay, so the question is now what this model has to do with 2 plus 1. Just some simplicial model. Okay. So I'll give you several derivations of this model. I'm trying to see what does it have to do with 2 plus 1 gravity. You can use perturbation theory. You could use BF theory or Chern-Simon theory to derive the Panzano-Reggi model. I'll tell you how to do it. And there is this non-perturbative definition, and I'll try to convince you that it does exist. First indication that there is something which has not, that in this model, Panzano-Reggi model, has something to do with 2 plus 1, and it has little to do with perturbation theory, comes from original result by Panzano and Reggi. They notice that CJ symbol from which you construct the amplitude has the asymptotics, which first of all, strangely enough, knows about volume of tetrahedron. So if you remember that we start, CJ symbol is a quantity associated with tetrahedron, and on edges there are spins. If you interpret these spins as lengths of a tetrahedron, for some strange reason you do that, then CJ symbol will know about volume, and if you take spins to be large, then CJ symbol will know about the volume of that geometrical tetrahedron, and it will be proportional to cosine of Reggi action for the tetrahedron, namely product of edge lengths with dihedral angles. And actually this was original motivation for Panzano-Reggi model. So we see that if you know what 3J symbol is. 3J symbol, if you couple two representations, if you take tensor product of two representations, you can decompose that tensor product into irreducible representations. The guy which does that for you, the map, is 3J symbol. Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. Then there is a very natural way to take four Clebsch-Gordans and contract them to get number. And that number is 6J symbol.
All right, but what's natural about it? What are we doing?
Okay. Yeah. The most naturally, the CJ symbol appears in identity of recoupling theory of representation. So,
I think there's a simpler way that
operators, you get three annual MENDA, and when you add them up, then you can get a basis where you add up one and two together, right? And then add three to get the total annual MENDA. Or you can add two and three together, and then one to get the total annual MENDA. Those will both give you some set of states with the total annual MENDA. And the unitary matrix that connects you between them, right? Is
you need four angular momenta here, right? That's what I was trying to draw here, right? So there are different bases. There are different ways to couple four angular momenta. You can couple them through this channel and through this channel. And the coefficient here is sigma symbol. Anyway, sigma symbol arises naturally when you study tensor products, more complicated, not just 2-to-1 tensor product, but if you study complicated tensor products of representations, sigma symbol is the thing which relates you different ways to pair these tensor products.
I think the deepest way to say it is expresses the associativity of the algebra.
Yeah. Okay. But at this level, I just wanted to show you that this is the model, and I will explain you why it's the model of two-Poisson gravity. That's the attitude. So this is just the motivation. It tells you that for some reason spins must be interpreted as lengths, and then you see that there is a relation between representation theory and geometry arising. And we'll see more of that later. Okay, now I want to show perturbative derivation. So as I said, path integral is well defined. So we can try to calculate that path integral. So what I'm calculating now is integral dE d omega of e to the I e way f. So I'm calculating amplitude for the spacetime. I'm calculating path integral for a given manifold. And it's so we can define it using perturbation theory. Now, to get to Panzano-Reggie model, there is one very simple possibility to get Panzano-Reggie model. You reformulate Chern-Simons, you reformulate this BF theory as Chern-Simons. Then you use perturbation theory, definition of Chern-Simons path integral. And then you can simply prove that Panzano-Reggie amplitude is given by the absolute value squared of Chern-Simons amplitude. And actually, it's better to do that in the context of cosmological constant. And this is the simplest way to see that deformation level of 2i0 model, which will be here, instead of Panzano-Reggie amplitude, I'll have 2i0 amplitude. Deformation level of that 2i0 amplitude will be related to cosmological constant. So this, basically what you do, I don't want to go to that proof, but you write BF as two copies of Chern-Simons. Then at the quantum level, you prove that 2i0 is equal to Chern-Simons squared if deformation parameter of 2i0 is equal to something to the level of Chern-Simons. It's related to the level of Chern-Simons. And that's the way you see the relation between cosmological constant and deformation parameter. But this way is bad for my purposes because this just relates you total path integrals. It just relates you total Panzano-Reggie amplitude to this path integral. And I want to see how sum over spins arises. How the 2i0 amplitude or Panzano-Reggie amplitude consists of two parts. First, it's amplitude for given label triangulation, and then it's the sum over labelings. I want to see how amplitude for label triangulation arises. And this way, I cannot see that because I get only the whole sum. This is a relation for the whole for the result of the sum. So let me
What's the signature of your metric?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I will be here I'll be working with plus 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 signature, so my group is SO3, and I'm doing integral with I here. So I'm doing quantum mechanics of metrics of Euclidean signature, which is a very strange thing to do. But I do that motivated by once I understand that, we'll try to change the signature of the metric by changing the group and just calculate the same path integral. But then it will become real quantum mechanics of manifolds of Lorentzian signature. So I'm studying something very strange, which is not Euclidean quantum gravity. I'm studying quantum mechanics of metrics of Euclidean signature. Okay. That's what I'm about to show.
Even though it's complex in the other one.
This integral will not be complex. You see that because his summer is sort of E of positive orientation and negative orientation, you will get cosine here. That's the reason why you get cosine. So even naively, you would say that this must be real because you summer both orientations. Okay, let me now divide this integral into two steps. And here I'm using perturbative definition of path integral. So first step will be, I choose triangulation of space-time. Then I label edges with irreducible representations. Then I impose a constraint, namely I say that if I look at the boundary, if I look at the dual face, this is the dual face, it's the thing which you construct by connecting centers of tetrahedra. And so it's a thing which has the topology of a disk. If I look at the boundary of this, now I want to impose the constraint that the holonomy around this boundary, the holonomy of my connection omega, is in the conjugacy class determined by this representation J sitting on this link. I'm using the fact that edges are in one-to-one correspondence with dual faces here. So I impose that constraint. Then I integrate over all omegas and all e's with that constraint. And I use perturbative definition of path integral. I just do that. And then I sum over all labelings. If I first introduce that constraint and then I summed over all labelings, it's still the same path integral, right? Because when I sum over all conjugacy classes, I didn't change my measure. So it was just a trick to divide integration into two parts. But I can, up to subtleties, it's not hard to show that the result of first step will give you just Fanzano-Reggie model, Fanzano-Reggie amplitude. It will give you the quantity which depends on the spins in the way as Fanzano-Reggie amplitude does depend.
I guess I'm confused. J3 is just one generator.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's one conjugacy class.
Yeah. I'm just saying that constraint is that.
Constraint. I don't really
understand. No. So this is a particular conjugacy class. There are many conjugacy classes, right? You can say that, for example, think about Lie algebra of SO2. Lie algebra, there are lots of orbits of the group in the Lie algebra, which are spheres of particular radius.
Wait, I'm thinking of the direct representation. The two-dimensional representation.
Oh yeah, it's a particular conjugacy. It corresponds to a particular conjugacy class.
There's only one class.
Yeah. For other J's. No, basically every representation corresponds to one conjugacy class. Think about orbits in the Lie algebra. It's not a representation because this is just the group element. And group element is a group element. And is the question, what is conjugacy class? Or
no.
This is some.
Restricted to take values in a certain representation?
No. Group element is just a group element. It cannot take values in some representation. Right?
Okay, wait. Why don't you start me from the beginning? Make the statement what you're saying over.
This is a group element. This is a group element here. I just take one generator of the Lie algebra, I multiply it by spin J, and I exponentiate that. And it's a group element, some group element, mm-hmm. some particular group element. Then if I act, no, it's a representation. It's number, it's just number. Yeah.
Okay.
Then I take, I act by the group by multiplying JJ minus one on this guy. And I get lots of group elements.
Oh, you get all
and
rotations that's, through
yeah,
angle.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So you sum over labelings J,
mm-hmm.
it's going to quickly remove this constraint.
Yes.
The index J is 3, right? Labels representations of S.
That's S3. A good point. Actually, you can make sense of that and you can motivate why this is correct by using Fourier analysis on the group. You can show that. I want to say, if you. It's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing. You can show that. It's the same thing. You don't change anything by doing that.
So
basically because that's what I'm trying to explain. If you do Fourier transform of a function,
well,
say,
it's really J mod was 2 pi, right?
Here.
Yeah.
No, it's not mod 2 pi.
J is 2 pi.
You can say that J3 is mod 2 pi. That's the right way to say it, because Lie algebra cover the part of Lie algebra which covers the group is just some finite part. It's just some the coordinates. Lie algebra is R3.
J is the angle. Little j.
It's no, I wouldn't say that. J is actually J is a discrete. It's a spin. So is that part confusing? I can explain that more. It all makes sense if you study Fourier analysis on the group. It just all makes sense.
Where is the integral over omega being carried out in the interior of the
tetrahedron? Everywhere. Yeah. The only constraint is that the holonomy around the dual face is fixed. Its conjugacy class is fixed. I think I'm using some notion, some facts from geometric quantization, namely that conjugacy classes are in one-to-one correspondence with representations. That's what I'm using. But I'm claiming that if you do that, and if you use perturbation theory definition of path integral, you get Panzano-Reggie model. So that's the way to see how Panzano-Reggie model can be obtained.
Are you going to explain how you
no.
How that,
no.
How do you get the fixed case
from
that?
You will see, I'll give you another definition, the derivation, and you'll see how the symbol arises there.
Is there something important in the study of this?
Yeah, it is. Basically, it's infinite. That's the subtlety.
Okay.
And the way to make it not infinite, you have to gauge fix. And there are lots of different ways to gauge fix. And that's the subtlety. For example, it's known that, actually, without cosmological constant, these subtleties are not, there are not many different ways to gauge fix. But with cosmological constant, different ways to gauge fix, for example, give you different definitions of Chern-Simons perturbation theory, and those different definitions even give you different types of knot invariants. So it's really rich subject, and there are important subtleties. But for BF, so for zero cosmological constant, it's very simple because theory is one loop exact. The only infinity which arises there is it can be very easily gauge fixed, and the only infinity, the only infinity here arises because action is invariant under E goes to E plus D of some function. And it's not the symmetry of gravity at all. It's some symmetry you got by writing gravity in this form. And you want to gauge fix that symmetry because it gives you infinity. And there is a simple way to gauge fix. And then you get rid of infinity. By the way, this is why Panzano-Reggie model diverges. That's exactly the reason why it. Because Panzano-Reggie model is model with this not being gauge fixed, and that's why it diverges. Okay, so this was my perturbative definition or derivation of Panzano-Reggie model. Now my non-perturbative derivation, and I'll give you two non-perturbative ways to understand Panzano-Reggie model. So this is way number one. Here I'll be trying to think of Panzano-Reggie model as quantum Reggie calculus. What I mean by that. So let me split my space-time into tetrahedra again. And let me take idea of Reggie that curvature, you can approximate curvature and metric by chunks of flat space-time glued together. In this way of thinking, curvature leaves only in three dimensions. It will leave only on edges of triangulation. So then what I do, I approximate my action. So first of all, I split my action into integrals over tetrahedra only. So they're chunks of space-time, and I consider one integral. So I consider action for one tetrahedron. Then I know that, or I want to approximate this action by saying that F is concentrated along the edge only. Curvature is dimensional and lives on the edge. And what I do, I define this as being summary edges of the following things. So it's a trace of two Lie algebra elements. For every edge, you have two Lie algebra elements. One X, its definition or physical meaning, is just the integral of the frame along the edge. And so the frame was one form, it was Lie algebra valid one form, you integrate, you just get element of Lie algebra. That's my X here. My Z here is, I take an edge, I calculate holonomy around that edge, and actually by this path I take it to be the boundary of dual phase as before. And here my Z is that Lie algebra element which I should exponentiate to get the holonomy. So Z encodes information about the curvature around this edge. That's what Z does. There is a subtlety again that Z is defined only up to conjugacy, because I don't know where I start here, which point, but there is a way. Basically, you then define analog of discrete gauge transformations, and this completely fixes where all this, what ZE is, by requiring that this discretized action is gauge invariant. I will not go into those details, but this is the main idea. Yes?
Gauge invariant is boring, because I mean, trace of E by F, their gauge invariance is no problem because they're all evaluated at the same point. Now mm-hmm. you're splitting it a bit to XE
right.
and ZE.
Mm-hmm.
And now this, the XE is evaluated along the edge up here.
Right.
So supposing I make a gauge transformation just somewhere along the edge. But I would like to see what is the relation between. Are the gauge transformations along the edge somehow tied with the gauge transformation along the boundary of the dual
yes.
phase?
Yes. I think heuristics here is that because interior is flat, then there is for every tetrahedron there is just one gauge transformation. So I define my discrete gauge transformations as so for every tetrahedron there will be a group element, and that will be the generator of my discrete gauge transformation, and axis. So X for every edge will transform in the same way. There is just so all edges which belong to this tetrahedron will transform with this group element. And so all holonomies which start from the center, so if U is the holonomy which starts and ends in the center of tetrahedron, then it will transform in the same way. G, U, G minus 1.
Yeah, I'm trying to see the connection between this and, you know, the way I've always thought about evaluating this, which is just, you know, you have the integral of e to the I, you know, e wedge f, the integral over e, and you get a delta function on
right.
f.
Right, it's very much related. Yes, it is very much related.
That's exact, right? It just reduces to an integral over flat connection, and so you know you don't have anything unless you have sort of non-trivial topology. Introducing all these tetrads and assigning curvatures to each of the
you're right.
Edges, you know, looks like it's a lot of wasted effort and a lot of extra complication.
That way would not work for more complicated theories. For example, if you do BF theory with cosmological constants, then there is no way like that because you don't get delta function. Right? For curvature is not flat anymore. And actually, you can even show that in BF theory, that integral is dominated by flat connections. But for cosmological constant case, it's not true. Flat connections are. Yes.
Let me make a comment that there's two points to your question. Why one do that, and then what's the connection? Well, let me skip the first part. the connection is that...
Kelly, I will explain that, so I think you should not... I will... My next transparencies will be explaining this delta function thing. Yeah. And why I do that? Because this way will be generalizable to lots of theories. And... Okay, so then I... define discretized measure as analog of integral over connections will be just lots of integrals over group elements. And analog of integral over E over the frame will be lots of integrals over X, X is. So my variables now, if I use those X's and Z's to write down the action will depend only on group elements, bunch of group elements, and a bunch of X's to the algebra elements. And then I can use this measure to integrate over them. And so what's the meaning of this procedure? I think the best interpretation for this, I'll show you, next experience is I'll show you how it works for lots of theories. And interpretation of this, I think the right one would be to say that we're trying to define measure, non-perturbatively, define measure in the path integral. And you know that usual definition of the measure in the path integral, you define it for cylinder functional. You define what's the result of path integral of some given simple function, which is really a function of finite number of arguments. And then you define your path integral for this function, and then you take limit, you approximate any other function by cylinder functions, and then you take the limit. And I think that's what is going on here. And we're not yet at the stage that we can say that this is the definition of the measure from the mathematical point of view. We cannot even prove that this gives a good definition of the measure. But so from the mathematical point of view, I don't know whether it's a good measure or not, but I'll try to convince you that this if I do this procedure for various theories, I get reasonable results. Okay, this is one definition, one derivation of Fanzano-Reggie model. Let me show you why it gives Fanzano-Reggie model now. So here is the calculation. So I replace my path integral, as I said, by this is now the action. It's a bunch of it's a sum of traces of x, z. And here is a product of integrals over group elements. And here is a product of over like number of copies of the Lie algebra. So there are lots of ways to do the calculation. And the result will be Fanzano-Reggie model. Let me show you how you can do the calculation. First, you can integrate over z?
No, T.
Oh, T. It's a tetrahedron. E is the edge. Yeah. So you can first integrate over x's, and you can use this formula, which is not quite correct formula, but you can make sense of it again using Fourier analysis on the group. There is precise version of this formula. You can use this result to convert this path integral into so all these integrals over x's of exponentials just become delta functions of products of group elements, where group elements are group elements around these dual faces, these are g's. Then you integrate over the group. Oh, yeah. First, you decompose these delta functions using Fourier transform. You decompose them into characters. That's the standard formula. So delta function is just sum over all reps of dimensions with characters. And then, so you got sum over, now every h becomes labeled by representation, and you sum over those representations. Now you integrate over groups, over group elements, and then you get the Fanzano-Reggie model. Now another way to derive it is you split integral over x's into sum over orbits, and then integral over the orbit. And orbits in the Lie algebra. X is actually it's element of the dual to the Lie algebra, and there are coadjoint orbits in the Lie algebra. And you just define this measure here, define these dx as being given by sum over these orbits, and then integral for x over each orbit. Then this is what you get. I just rewrote this expression. So this is as before, but then you have sum over orbits, integrals over orbits. This integral over orbit just gives you character. It's Kirilov formula. And you are back to the previous bunch of integrals over product of characters. And then let me show you how you do this integration, just very briefly, to see how 6J symbol arises. So as I said, these characters here are taken, the argument is a product of group elements around the dual face. For example, let's take this particular edge of, this is dual edge. This dual edge will be shared by three dual faces. There are just three dual faces which meet on that edge. So what will arise there will be, you will have three matrix elements in some three different representations of the group. Because remember, the character, the way to write character, you take matrix elements and then you join them together. That's what you do to get the character. Now, the integral of three matrix elements integrated over the argument, that's the result. You just get product of three J symbols. You get two 3J symbols. So what that means, this is a matrix which can, remember that matrix element, it has two indices, M and N, say, and these indices are represented by N's of this line here. So, for example, this matrix is the one which has three indices, and it tells you how to convert three representations into trivial. So these are just the usual 3J symbols. And now when you do that for a particular tetrahedron in the triangulation, so when you integrate over this dual edge, that dual edge, this one and this one here, there are just four dual edges inside one tetrahedron, you get just 6J symbol. And that's the way you get it. What was your question? What was your question?
The depth function of the curvature.
Yeah, I think this answered your question because I showed that my definition of this measure is it gives you product of delta functions. So your intuitive expectation that in BF theory only flat connections dominates, it's here is correct, it's realized, because you get, you see that the measure you get is just delta function concentrated on.
And you see that it's independent of your triangulation?
Only at this level you can show that. I don't know the way to see that this integral at this level it will be independent. Okay, I think I should again emphasize my interpretation of this. We gave a discrete definition of this measure, so it's a kind of cylinder function definition of the measure in the path integral. And then we calculated that integral over a finite number of copies of the variables. And then the idea would be, of course, to try to take triangulation, to try to take cylinder functional, to introduce more and more arguments and take the limit. And in that case, it just turns out that the result is triangulation independent, so the limit does exist. So this idea works in this case. Okay, this was one derivation. Now let me give you a very, very different derivation, but of the same model. And this derivation is motivated by original result of Panzana and Regia, that 6J symbols know something about geometry of tetrahedron. So the idea here is completely strange idea. Just try to take a tetrahedron and quantize it, and I'll tell you what that means. And then we'll see that amplitude for quantum tetrahedron is just 6J symbol. And then it's very natural to take a product of amplitudes for lots of tetrahedra and form amplitude of triangulation. Okay. So classical tetrahedron can be characterized by three vectors. If you tell me, if you give me three vectors like this up to rotations, it completely characterizes tetrahedron up to rotations. Now, instead of working with three vectors, it's just convenient, as you'll see why, to introduce three more vectors, these ones here. Of course, these three vectors are just linear combinations of these ones, and this is what these constraints say. So I'm introducing six vectors satisfying constraints, and actually only three constraints here are independent. The fourth constraint is some linear combination of previous three. Okay, now vector in R3 can be thought of as an element of the Lie algebra. Let me just, for some strange reason, call my vector, let me just say that it's element of the Lie algebra. So by that I mean that I'm introducing Poisson, I'm saying that elements do not commute, components of this vector do not commute anymore. I'm introducing Poisson structure on this R2. And then once I've done that, I can quantize it. And quantization is just geometrical quantization of R3. So what that means is that these vectors, they become, alpha beta here are just indices. They tell me what vector I'm talking about. So every E alpha beta becomes an operator in this Hilbert space, where it's just the tensor, it's just direct sum of our irreducible representations of SO2, of SU2. So again, my E becomes an operator in this Hilbert space. So what happened is that I associated to every edge a Hilbert space, and now my vector, which was that edge, becomes an operator in this Hilbert space. Now, I want to take now face of my tetrahedron, so it has three vectors. So that means that I have to take h to the 3. I have to take tensor product of Hilbert spaces for three edges. But now I have a constraint. Constraint was that if I take sum of this vector plus this one, it vanishes. And it's very easy to see what that constraint means, because that operator of the sum, so you have something like E plus E plus E. All these E's, they act in different copies of H. So natural way to say what that operator is to add a bunch of ones here. One, and this is zero. So this is now a good operator in H to the 3. And what this operator tells you is that you have to take only invariant elements of H to the 3. Only invariants. And these invariants are just generated by all Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So now I'm introducing Hilbert space for a face, which is just it's spanned by 3J symbols. Now I want to glue these faces together to get Hilbert space for a tetrahedron. And there is just one very natural way to glue these 3J symbols in some gauge invariant way. You want the result to be gauge invariant. And the way to do that is just to glue four of them by a number of faces. Four 3J symbols you glue in an object which is gauge invariant, which is 6J symbol.
What does gauge invariant mean in this context, this sort of game you're playing?
There is an action of the group at this point. So, for example, if you act here, the result is not the same. There is an action. So this guy is not gauge invariant.
You asked us to play this game where we try to make a quantum tetrahedron gauge in the game as well. I'm just trying to understand where it comes from.
It's the action of the group in that particular representation. It's the natural action of the group. When you quantize group geometry, when you do geometric quantization, group acts in the representation space. Okay. And that's that action, which I called.
You want some quotient
outside. Yeah. And the physical meaning of, so why do I want gauge invariant amplitude for my tetrahedron? Because I want to characterize tetrahedron only up to rotations in R3. And so that's why I wanted to have something. Yeah. Heuristic interpretation of the gauge symmetry is rotation in R3. So now I got amplitudes for tetrahedron. So Hilbert space for tetrahedron now is spanned by these 6J symbols. And now you can see what's the meaning of this game. Remember that every E here was associated with the edge of a tetrahedron. Now E squared is just the length squared of this particular edge. Now in representation, irreducible representation J, E squared is just the Casimir, quadratic Casimir. So its eigenvalue is JJ plus 1. So you can see that J's here, the irreducible representations labeling my elements of the basis of this Hilbert space, they have meaning of lengths of an edge of a tetrahedron. So then the meaning of this 6J symbol is simply it's an amplitude for a tetrahedron given that its edge lengths are these particular specified numbers. Of course it's a game, and what's the meaning of it, but we got 6J symbol, which we get some other way. So I'm trying to say that this gives additional interpretation for the previous construction. We define path integral in some way, and this gives geometric interpretation of of that construction. Yes?
Would you say that your choice here, which I think was not at all unique, is then justified by the triangulation dependence?
I don't want to say that, no.
And then you have to have an argument why you choose. I mean, there are many, many invariants you could write down, which...
From four three J symbols?
Sure, from attention problems.
You can
embed any invariant operator or sandwich it between them, for example. Cut it to thing in half and put in any invariant operator.
Give me an example.
Cut the thing in half.
Here?
Yeah, just cut it somewhere.
And what should I put there?
Tensor what comes from the top together, tensor what comes from the top bottom together. And put it through a sum of projection operator.
But there is nothing. There is nothing. You can put here only the intertwiner from this representation to this representation. And there is nothing. There is just unique intertwiner.
I decided that I want to project that only in the 72nd representation. Is there anything that satisfies your rules?
Something else will happen. My tensor product will not be tensor product anymore.
Sure. There are lots of operators that live in tensor products there. I mean, I think that the thing that makes it right is that it's triangulation independent.
No, I don't think that that's the...
Why can't I just cut your amplitude in half and I put it in any projection operator?
I'm saying that there isn't one.
There's one for every representation.
That will screw something up, something else.
Sorry, triangulation independence, I don't know when.
No. I don't want to use that motivation because my motivation for this is to generalize it to higher dimensions. And in higher dimensions, I will not be able to say that I do that because I get triangulation independent result. You understand that? And I'm saying that maybe...
Well, that certainly looks more natural. You don't pick out every
three.
Yeah. The other one is picking out some representation, right?
It's the simplest thing, but it's not...
But in any case, the question is to be asked later, to get some other theory later, and if that theory has something to do.
I think I'm trying to motivate some construction. This is nice geometrical construction, which tells you that there is some relation between representation theory and geometry. And I think I would not use this construction as a definition of some model. But I like to have this construction because it tells me what's the geometric interpretation of some model.
What happened to all this? I mean, since it's a geometric interpretation, you have all those identities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they got imposed. That's the way they got imposed. Because I look at invariants.
That's a bit strong condition.
There are lots of conditions. I'm sure even you can formulate theorem given those conditions. That's the unique way to do that. You cannot project that. If you take only some representations, you don't have tensor product anymore because it's you don't have a category, nice category with nice rules anymore. And if you take only one representation, we should argue about that later.
Isn't that the sort of construction exactly the same as what you read in books on angular momentum?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what is good about that construction, it indeed tells you that there is some relation between geometry, quantum geometry, and representation theory.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to explore here. We're trying to say that it will exist in any dimension.
We're waiting
and
for the generalization.
Okay. So what I want to say here, it's good to have both of these constructions. Each one of them, you should think and interpret those two constructions differently. One as a definition of the path integral measure, and this one, number two, as geometric interpretation of that measure. Okay, and I would say that now I will show you how to generalize this. Unlike perturbative definition of path integral, which cannot be generalized to higher dimensions, these ones can be. Okay, I want to... How much time do I have? I don't have time. Okay, that's why I have this summary. Because I knew that I wouldn't have time. I want to say what are the results in higher dimensions, and then maybe I'll show you how to get to them. Okay. So first of all, to formulate, to apply procedure number one to higher dimensional gravity, what we do, we reformulate gravity, higher dimensional gravity, as BF plus constraints. Namely, we write gravity Lagrangian as BF plus some quadratic constraints, so some Lagrange multipliers, BB. And varying with these Lagrange multipliers, you get constraints saying that B comes from the frame, and then this theory is equivalent to Einstein theory, or to Palatini, to first-order Palatini Lagrangian. This can be done in any dimension, as I'll show you. And then I use definition of the same idea, the same procedure number one, I apply to this theory. And it just goes through, and I'll tell you how it happens exactly. One gets what can be called higher dimensional analogs of Panzano Reggio models.
Higher dimensional gravity, do you mean integral curvature, or do you mean...
Just Einstein, Einstein-Hilbert action, with cosmological constant probably, but cosmological constant. For high dimensions, I don't know quite how to do that. For four dimensions, we know how to do it, but not for high dimensions. You can start from quantization of geometric D-simplex, simplex in D dimensions. You can just generalize those ideas before, and you can quantize it, and you get amplitude for D-simplex. This amplitude is the same as the one you get using procedure number one. So again, the two procedures will give you the same models. So another result is that amplitude, that simplex amplitude, if I study its asymptotics for large spins, there will be no spins, but I'll show you there will be analog of spin. So if you study asymptotics of that amplitude for large quantum numbers, the amplitude will have asymptotics of cosine of Reggie action. So it's again as in three dimensions. So it's really generalization of Panzano Reggie model. And there are Lorentzian analogs of these models. Namely, you start from gauge group being not compact, but some non-compact gauge group, for example, SO21 in three dimensions. And you can formulate models like that using non-compact gauge groups. Okay. Very important question is, now we will not have triangulation independence. So I'll show you, we'll get some models which assign amplitude to a particular triangulation, but now they will depend on the triangulation. And in 2 plus 1, that problem was solved. We could take limit as triangulation gets more refined, and that limit exists because nothing depended on triangulation. Here there are two points of view now, because we have triangulation dependence. A lot of people, which do spin form models, they believe that we should sum our triangulations. And I think that's not my point of view, but that's point of this is sort of natural if you arrive to that from loop quantum gravity. And I don't know. I don't know what's the right point of view. But the other point of view is that you still have to take a refinement as triangulation gets more refined, and you should see if that path integral has a limit. Yes?
I'm not sure what your answer is for generalization here, but naively, if you had ignored that for a minute, it would seem that if two make sense, then one must be very divergent.
For example, Luis Bulatov model, which does that for you, which realizes two for you. In three dimensions, you can write model which generates all triangulations weighted with Panzano Reggie amplitude, and then sums over them. And that model is generated by some. It's a theory. Basically, it's path. So all that sum is generated by some path integral of some matrix theory. Of course, it does diverge, but I think a lot of hopes to make sense of that divergence somehow. Anyway, people study some of the triangulations, but this is not my point of view. Okay.
But the manifold is fixed.
Yeah, the manifold is fixed. Okay, how much time do I have?
But I think everyone is ready to know.
But it's... okay, maybe then I'll be more quick. So that's reformulation. So in higher dimensions, that's the action. It's now given by EEF. So that's equations of motion. You cannot use the... it's not of BF type. So we cannot use trick we used before. Namely, we replace BF by trace XZ. We cannot do that anymore here. However, if you redefine this combination EE, if you introduce densitized, it's a bivector with values in the Lie algebra. You can write down, actually, in this form, is BF, but you should impose constraints, namely constraints saying that B is of that form, B is E which E. And the way to do that is it turns out that you can write down action like this, which now depends on B, which is D minus 2 form, connection, and a bunch of Lagrange multipliers. So what is here? This F of B is 2 form, which is linear both in B and in Lagrange multipliers. And I don't write what it is because it's messy, but it's linear in B. That's the main thing. In any dimension, the action you get, the constraints you get are quadratic. That's something. That's resolved by myself, Laurent Friedel, and Raymond Poussio, and we didn't expect at all that it will be quadratic in any dimension. It's something nice. So what are the constraints? The constraints you get by varying with that, with respect to that Lagrange multiplier, are BB, which has four indices, must be completely anti-symmetric in these four indices. So if you anti-symmetrized with respect to these four indices, the upper four indices, it must be completely anti-symmetric in upper four indices. I could write that using a bunch of epsilons, but I don't want to do that. It's messy. This constraint is equivalent to three following sets of constraints. And it's nice to rewrite this in this form because I'll explain the geometrical meaning of every of this constraint. So this constraint, if you take a raw sigma to be the same as mu nu, it must be zero because it must be completely anti-symmetric. This constraint, what it implies is that two form, b nu nu, so it's something with values in the Lie algebra. I, j are Lie algebra indices. So this constraint implies that b mu nu determines a plane in RD. Not every, in D dimensions, not every two form determines a plane. Only simple, we call that simple, B's determine a plane. So that's the geometrical meaning of this. Now, intersection constraint, if you take one of the indices the same, it tells you that these two planes, in case these are already simple, this constraint tells you that these two planes intersect along a line. So that's what we have here. And normalization constraints, that's the leftover, they don't have that simple geometrical meaning. But probably they're most important, because I'll tell you that they have very important interpretation. In the model, they play a very important role. Okay. Now, the idea of quantization of BF-like theories, so to quantize that theory, BF with constraints.
What is the difference between this action and the action which Ted Jacobson was using with other collaborators, where phi becomes...
He was working in four dimensions. That's any dimension. And I think also any dimension. Yeah, that's very important. And also, I think he was using self-dual variables. He was using, his B was self-dual part. Yeah, in any dimension, there is no self-duality. So you cannot use self-duality. And we don't use self-duality here. So to quantize theories of this type, let me consider a theory of the general type BF plus some functional, some polynomial in D. So the way to do that, you can first calculate generating functional for BF theory, namely the guy which BF theory plus current for B. And then this must be true, that the depth integral amplitude for this action must be just given by, you just act by this exponentiated polynomial of B's, where you replace B's by variational derivative. You act on the generating functional, you evaluate result on J is equal to zero. And you can calculate that, this integral here, the generating functional, by the procedure I described before BF, but you can modify it now. Instead, basically the idea of modification is that instead of integral concentrated on flat connections, you use integral where holonomies are required to be concentrated on currents, on what current tells you. So the current can be integrated over this dual phase, and then you get Lie algebra element, and then holonomy around dual phase must be concentrated on the group element determined by the current. I will not go into details of this procedure, but you can use procedure number one to calculate that Z of G in any dimension. The group changes, right. But the group, I never used really the fact that it was SU2. I was just using free analysis on the group when I calculated these integrals. B is D minus 2 form. Yeah, but now it will be concentrated on D minus 2 simplices. For example, in 4 dimensions, it will live on faces. But it will always, by duality, it will always live on something 2 dimensional, on dual faces. And that's what is used here. So actually, all these things will be really 2 dimensional, all these calculations. So to make sense of this integral, we use 2 dimensional BF theory to really calculate this. And that's the way it's calculated. There is a very good question which can be asked here, because I'm claiming that we know what that Z of J is. But, for example, you can rewrite usually Young-Mills theory in any dimension in this form. You just write down B wedge B dual. And by claiming that I know what that is, I seem to be claiming that I know what this Young-Mills theory in any dimension is.
You're not really claiming that because you still have like a continuing limit.
Right, and I think the answer is that. Yeah.
And you also have to do that functional
derivative.
Right. Which, are you going to do that?
I'll show you. They become constraints which we can solve. Okay. So I calculate the Z of G. Now I want to impose constraints and on the Z of G. First of all, the meaning of what does it mean to impose constraint on generating functional? Because generating functional, it either does satisfy the constraint, it's some function of J. So what do I do? Remember my action was phi. So now my integral becomes... I had still integral over phi. I still had to... What I calculated was integral over B and A. I still have to integrate over phi. And I do that by phi B, variational derivative. Yeah, it's a function in space-time. So it's a field. And then I must act on Z of J. So the meaning of this integral, it must impose the constraints, because that's what it was doing before. Maybe not obviously, but so one way to solve this problem is, it turns out that because this Z of J is given by sum of representations, it turns out that there are some terms here in this Z of J which just do satisfy some constraints. So remember, I divided my constraints into simplicity, intersection, and something else. It turns out that there are some...
I think the notation, the same with me, the notation is misleading. You're not phi is a function, it's not a function of E of J.
So yeah, it's...
You need a little bit more.
Right.
Phi is an index, not an index.
Yeah,
it's just a standard.
Yeah.
It's multiplier.
Yeah, it's multiplied. It's a function. It's a field. It's Lagrange multiplier.
Right.
Yes.
So
yeah.
That's a standard integral of an explanation of the delta function.
Yes.
You're saying that this thing is the same as taking D of J and restricting it to the class of J.
Yes. Not class of J's, but class of representations. I'm claiming that Z of J is a complicated sum of terms, lots of terms. And some of these terms, they satisfy these constraints.
I mean, you have to apply this and then say J goes to zero.
Yes.
But you're not saying the whole integral
goes to
zero.
No, I just...
You're saying that there is a definition which is a different definition of D of J, which comes by restricting the representation to sum over which implements the delta function.
Yeah, some of the constraints can be implemented. You still have to interpret this integration as constraints, because that's what it is. And I'm saying that some of the constraints can be defined by redefining the Z of J. And this redefinition of Z of J has very natural geometric interpretation. That's what I'll show you. It really is the way to get to the simplex. Because the result we shall get here will have geometric interpretation in terms of geometric simplex. The amplitudes I'll get, they have to do with geometric simplex in V dimensions. Maybe I should go ahead. So let me tell you how we impose that constraint here. So this Z of J will depend on current only through matrix elements in all possible representations of SOD of exponentiated current. So in this form. It turns out that there are just some representations for which this operator acting on these matrix elements is zero. And these are simple representations. So what are these representations? They're related to certain orbits.
For the others, it's not zero.
For the others, it's not zero, yes. That's a good question. How do I know that I should take only these ones?
How do you know there's no cancellation?
I think we take only these ones because they have geometric interpretation. And they have geometric interpretation we want. So remember the procedure number two where I quantize geometric simplex.
But this is not.
Yeah,
so this show back, you're not deriving.
Right.
So, well, but what you could still say that this is maybe a section of the theory, the best section of the theory has fallen into geometric interpretation. This may not be the complete solution for the reason you said.
Okay, it could be far from it.
Yeah, it could.
It could be far from it. So, but I think the strategy is to get the model and then see what properties it has.
But isn't it stronger than presenting it through the J? I think is weakening your argument. You introduce the J, you have a delta function on each phase or these tetrasimplices of various dimensions. You have delta functions, and you're solving the delta functions locally. In the function, in the sum over because they become projection operators, delta functions become projection operators, and you're just simply solving them. And there is, I think, the solutions are unique when you work through the ones you know.
Probably it can be presented stronger, but I don't see the way to do that. Let me describe the geometrical meaning of this simple representation. They're very nice. So they're the so-called spherical harmonics representations. They're related to spheres as d minus 1. The way to get them is, so basically requirement is that some Lie algebra element is simple. What that means is that it can be represented as a wedge product. That's the definition of simplicity. What that means is that when diagonalized by the action of the group, there is only one block here with 0, 0 on the diagonal and something sitting here. So there is only one 2 by 2 block. And if you now look at the orbits, so if you look at conjugacy classes of these X in the Lie algebra, you get orbit in the Lie algebra. And you can induce representations which correspond to these orbits. And these are these simple representations. It's important they will be characterized only by one parameter. Basically, the thing which sits here at this point here. There is only one parameter which these orbits are labeled by one parameter. They're analogous spheres. In the case of SU2, we just had one parameter which was the radius of the sphere. So there are orbits like that in SOD, which are they're most degenerate orbits of SOD. They're usually sometimes they're called small representations of SOD also. Okay, now what are the other constraints? And actually, here, there's a choice which I think I will not describe too much, but I should tell you what happens here. There was also intersection constraint, which by claim, which was saying that B and B intersect along a line. You can choose one way. You can choose to impose this intersection constraint in a very non-trivial way. There is a non-trivial solution to that constraint, which comes if you consider geometric D-simplex and quantize it, and trying to impose in that quantum Hilbert space. You try to impose analog of that intersection constraint. You get some solution to that intersection constraint. So that solution turns out to be the solution. It tells you that the vertices which you should use to couple representations, these simple representations, are of special type. And that's what you can use as a solution. You can just claim that that is a solution of this intersection constraint. And you can just restrict all vertices here in Z of J to those types of vertices. It turns out that solving intersection constraint in this hard way, you also get automatic solution to normalization constraints. All of them get solved automatically. I told you that this can be motivated by quantization of geometric force simplex, and that was the original Barrett-Crane model, which they proposed. They proposed it in four dimensions, but it can be generalized to any dimension. Now, there is another choice, which we just found recently with Carlo and some other people. You can choose some other vertices, which are much more natural from the point of view of this BF theory. Namely, if you just indeed try to impose constraints which this BF theory tells you for vertices, you find some other solution in which there is no further restriction on vertices here in the ZOG. You just do one step, you restrict representations to be simple. And then the vertices of this generating functional, they satisfy the intersection constraint, but not in the naive way as they do for geometric force simplex. But I don't want to say more here, but they do satisfy these intersection constraints in some precise way. The point here is that this is a single D-simplex. In triangulation, there are several D-simplexes, and they, in particular, they intersect. So, for example, in four dimensions, there is a tetrahedron, which is shared by two four simplices. And this simple constraint is constraint on the tetrahedron. And because it's shared by two four simplices, here that problem was just ignored. People just said that tetrahedron is a part of one D-simplex and we should impose that constraint only in one D-simplex. But because it's shared by two, this means that one constraint for that D-simplex, for that tetrahedron, should probably involve both D-simplexes. And if you understand constraint in that way, then there is no constraint at all. It just solves out, it's solved automatically. So there is no further restriction in two twiners. But then there is a problem with normalization constraints. They're not solved. And what we're seeming to find is that to solve them, if you try to just see what kind of solutions you get, you can get only non-local solutions. You cannot solve them in one simplex. If you do something in one simplex, try to solve it in one simplex, you should do something in the other simplex too. So you get something which looks like propagation. But this is very preliminary. This is just... So that's a new model.
What happened the first time? Did you solve the
normalization? Yes, you can. They get solved automatically. For each simplex individually. That's ignored. It has to be, but that was ignored. So people just satisfy constraints for every simplex. That way wasn't the way of the BF theory. People just solved constraints for one D simplex.
And it's a theory about just one.
Yeah, it's a theory about one simplex. Yes.
Maybe you can't really glue together.
No, that was the problem. People didn't know how to glue them. The original idea was just to multiply these amplitudes. But we see now that it's probably not right.
Well, I thought the status was that in four dimensions, this is the Barrett-Crane model. It's well defined for any triangulation, but there's no demonstration that it's equal, that it's in any sense quantum general relativity beyond one simplex. Is that what you're saying? Or
I'm saying something more. I think, yeah, it's just a model.
The demonstration that there's Rezzi calculus that are one simplex, but I thought at least the statement of the model is well defined for any triangulation.
Yeah. There is a model.
There's a model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well defined, just multiply.
Yeah, you just multiply amplitudes.
But you're not saying one is equal to two, though. You're saying
no. These are very different models. Mm-hmm. And we seem to be able to see some propagation here, and there is no propagation here. But again, we should understand what it means. Propagation. We do have a model here. Number two, and actually, this number two has additional motivation that. Before you impose normalization constraints, right? There is still a problem with normalization constraints. And what I'm saying is that if you try to impose them, you see that solutions will be non-local.
The formulation of the model is
there is no formulation of the model because these normalization constraints are not solved yet. There is no model.
But that's true also in one, right? Because
No, in one you just...
ignore it, right?
Yeah, you just...
That's not what
hyperlocal.
Yeah, it's hyperlocal, right.
The Barrett-Crane model is not so hyperlocalized. It's not a product of independent things in any because the same variable enters in various different areas.
Yeah, in that
it's
sense.
It's normally the sense of any local discretized quantum theory is local, the more than that. It is not well defined as a modification of BF theory. It's perfectly well defined as itself.
Right, but I think we want it to be this modification of BFT, that's what we need to be here. Then one hasn't solved that,
Right. But what is, just maybe the last comment here, because I'm going for too long anyway. This number 2, without normalization constraints being imposed, can be obtained as Bulatov type model, where you just work with functions on several copies of the sphere. And I think my next transparency is about that, and Bulatov transparency. So this is matrix model for this. You start from usual Bulatov type of model. You start from function on several copies of the group, and then you write down Lagrangian. For example, in 4D, you write down quadratic piece and phi to the fifth, where you glue this, the way you integrate over phi, the way you glue them, is you see that phi has 4 arguments. And this term is, that's what you do, you just take 2 phi, and then you put, these are the group elements, the arguments of phi, and then you integrate over this group elements. It's just a graphic notation for this term, what that term means. If you want something quadratic in 2 phi's, you just stick the leg. You can think of arguments of phi as being legs of phi, and then you just put them together and integrate over these legs. And this is what you do for the phi to the fifth term. It turns out that this, if you do Feynman, if you just perturbative definition of this path integral, and you expand in powers of lambda, this generates all triangulations weighted with certain weights. If you just indeed started from functions on several copies of the group, you get what is known as a GUI model. It's topological field theory. You get amplitudes which you get for triangulations will be triangulation independent, it turns out. However, you can restrict your phi on G to be just function on the sphere. This means being constant on cosets, so it's just function which is constant on some conjugacy classes, on right cosets, for example, which is just a sphere. So you can take your function to be function on several copies of the sphere, and then write down the same Lagrangian, and then you get the model which I described on the previous transparency, but normalization constraints are not imposed in that model. Okay, and my last transparency, actually it wasn't the last one, but prospects. What is interesting, at least it's interesting for me, one can try to see what is D goes to infinity, right? Quantum gravity. I don't know if it will make any sense, but there is very nice results from representation theory of SOD for D goes to infinity. It simplifies. And it's just a nice mathematical game. It's interesting for me. Find non-local solutions of normalization constraints, or just show that solutions are non-local in some sense. And maybe can they be interpreted as gravity waves? I think I don't understand what it means either. But the way we just try to get results and then interpret them.
Can you solve these constraints on lower dimensional embedded surfaces and sort of in some sense realize? Something like brains or strings,
direct excitation. I don't know.
That's my guess.
There is also a Lorentzian version of this model, which is of course much more interesting because it's physical. Namely, the group is non-compact gauge group, and there are very nice things happening there because there are, instead of one type of representations which we had for compact groups, there are 2 types of representations appear, and they are in correspondence with sort of space-like elements of triangulation and time-like elements of triangulation, and that the game becomes very interesting, and we hope that causal structure might appear from just recoupling rules of representations. Because we understand that this model comes from BF theory, so it's just path integral, we can try to calculate some correlation functions, for example, of 2 Bs or of 2 holonomies, and try to interpret that. This can be done. But probably it's hard, but it can be done now. And it might be, we should also try to understand refinement goes to infinity. That's of course the main problem, because it's the continuum limit. That's the definition of, and probably the hardest problems will be here. But one might use this Bulatov model, because Bulatov model somehow encodes, it has all these amplitudes in it. One might try to use, for example, trying to take only diagrams with infinite number of vertices somehow. One might try to use some techniques using the Bulatov model to understand what is refinement goes to infinity. Okay, that's it. Yes.
About the very last thing, there is this stuff by Derek Kreimer on the normalization group and Feynman diagrams that he has not so positive about, I think, which seems as if they could bring us in the
If it
have.
Could, that would be nice, of course, but I don't know.
So what's the connection between, I mean, we heard Carlos talk.
The connection is that people see that if you just apply Hamiltonian, exponentiate Hamiltonian constraint and apply it to spin networks, you get something which looks like spin foams. And if you take dual to a triangulation, it will consist of a bunch of two faces, of two-dimensional surfaces, which is also a spin foam.
But are you talking about the same physical theory as Carlos was talking about, or is the theory different?
There is no, on either side, there is a complete theory. And hope is that hope is that both ways, we should pursue both ways, and then they will help to understand what's the final theory. But
do they both agree in some sort of class or
something? You can ask the same question, for example, even in three dimensions. In three dimensions there is a Ponzano-Reggie model. The question is there any Hamiltonian constraint which corresponds, which gives you spin form model, which is the same as Ponzano-Reggie model, and nobody found such a Hamiltonian constraint yet. People were looking hard, even in three dimensions, nobody found such a Hamiltonian constraint.
So we should mainly understand this as development technique, so to sort of look at one theory, which is Einstein gravity in these numbers of dimensions, maybe tens of them.
I think what emerges here is philosophy that, first of all, you can treat pure gravity quantum mechanically. And now there is a way to do that with this path integral, with B of reformulation. And there is also a canonical way to do that.
Well, you have a toy model so far. You haven't yet got to the stage where you can argue that
it's the model of real thing. All right, then. Yeah. We should try. My purpose of my talk was to convince you that it's interesting and somebody should be doing that. And if, okay.
But you have there's one class of theories which one can get at from the quantum gravity and going up, or from this point of view. So it's the same class of theories. I think one perspective on it is that what makes the class is that the amplitude is not put in, it's variable, which is the same thing saying the symmetry, we know the symmetry, but we don't know the Lagrangian, the free choice of the Lagrangian, that the symmetries are fixed. And one perspective to take is that that's good because you should try to choose the theory, that is, choose the exact dynamics so that your last point is realized, so that there's a continuum limit. There's no continuum limit.
Maybe we should do that, but I think this BF way of looking at it must also be motivated. You should be, not any choice of this amplitude is allowed. You should be motivated, guided by some intuition, geometry intuition, or this BF theory intuition.
Supposing that there was just some choice of an amplitude that's expressed in the language of representation theory, that you could show had a classical limit, and its classical limit was general relativity or supergravity in some dimension, then wouldn't you say that was quantum theory of gravity, the classical limit was general relativity.
I would say it, if you show me such theory,
yeah,
I would say it.
Yeah, therefore it's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And whether or not, as a technical question, that form of the amplitude arose from some quantization procedure from starting with one classical action or another is probably not very relevant.
I think it's a question of what we should be doing. So we are trying to get to that amplitude starting from the action. If you don't want that truth, you can just guess. If you guess right, it's...
I would like to see at the end, make sure that You start with a lattice relation at some point, but there might or might not be good. But at least, you know, it's comforting that for weak fields, large distances, the product of amplitude has a saddle point, which is the classical equation of ammonia.
Right.
And here we started with an action of that form. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We did various things, but then that's our various concerns for some simplification of that. It'd be nice if some, make sure that that's what persists.
What is very interesting here is that you were worried that by solving simplicity constraint, I drop representation. I restrict myself only to simple representations. It turns out that the vertices which appear here, they contain all possible representations of SOD, not only simple ones. So the vertices, there will be four valent vertices in this model, and you can decompose those vertices into trivalent ones, and what will be sitting in the middle will be all possible representations for SOD.
Okay. I mean, the reality issue is one is this issue about value, but not part of the theory. But other issue is even within this way of solving the constraints, then you want really solve all the constraints.
Right. That's.
So I think
that's not finished.
Yeah, it's not finished. Right.
But
I think. So if that can be finished, then we can address this question.
Also, what is very nice about the constraints I did not solve, they are exactly... I did not solve the constraints. Let me look at that in four dimensions. So my constraints will be something like this. The ones I solved were one of these indices is the same. The ones I did not solve are exactly where all indices are different. The Lagrange multipliers for all indices are different. It's just the wild curvature. It's just the degree, local degrees of freedom of gravitational field. Exactly these Lagrange multipliers are just local degrees of freedom. The hard part. Yeah. But that's what probably we'll not be able to even solve them exactly, because that would mean that we solve exactly the theory.
In terms of getting back to David's point about you're trying to see that you have some constant classical limit, you made a comment that the higher dimensional theories, at least in some limits, gave you the sort of Reggie action.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So can you just remind me what that was?
Precise statement was that if you take amplitude of the wrong model, which I said model number one, Barrett-Crane model.
Oh, just that one.
Yeah, the one ultra-local, the one which just quantizes D-simplex. If you take that amplitude, and so that amplitude is labeled by a bunch of numbers. Remember that every representation sitting on the face now is just one number, the simple one. If you take this number going to infinity, then the amplitude is given by cosine of Reggie action. Yes.
For one
simplex. For one simplex, yes.
Yeah, but now I'm confused because, did Barrett-Crane make a mistake? I mean, they claim to solve in four dimensions those constraints and to...
No, they didn't. They didn't make a mistake. They solved all the constraints, but
so
just for one simplex.
Is that right?
Yeah. They didn't work with triangulation. They just quantized one simplex, and they solved all the constraints.
Here's the last.
Yes.
In three dimensions, at least the Bulatov model gives you an amplitude which contains a sum over all intermediate topologies.
Right. That's the problem of the model, by the way.
Yeah, and you expect that to diverge.
Yes.
Because, you expect it to diverge even for certain individual intermediate topologies.
Mm-hmm.
Are these models that you're talking about, should I picture those as sums over all topologies?
No, topology is restricted here because I'm... Implicitly, when I calculate this BF type integral, I assume that all dual faces are disks. That's where I put my topology. So this means that the topology I reproduce is just R, D.
Okay.
Actually, that's what we're trying to figure out in the connection with the last thing that Kelly was talking about. Which generation exactly, precisely, are being generated?
In the matrix model?
in the matrix, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the problem of matrix model, of Bulatov model, that it gives a sum of all possible topologies. In two dimensions, there is a way to, because you don't want to sum of all possible topologies, you want to take only planar topologies. And it turns out that n goes to infinity limit of your matrix model just gives you, keeps you that piece. In three dimensions, there is no such thing, because for even, yeah, there, even there is no such hope, because, for example, there is no one number which characterizes a topology. Yes. In two dimensions, Euler characteristic being zero meant, yeah, that's why I think summing over triangulations is hopeless. It just.
Just to go back to this question that Jim has been asking.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I completely understand your answer. We'll get our technical discussion later. But I mean, the hope is that you're saying that one is building a theory around here,
mm-hmm.
and Carlo's projector operator is building up here.
Yeah.
There are some points of contact, but mm-hmm. one doesn't see that the two things are the same at all.
One sees the same structure arising, but one does not see what Hamiltonian constraint in one approach corresponds to amplitude in the other approach. That's what we don't see yet.
So if that's the same thing, there is a single class of theories, and what's missing in this class of theories is the specification of the amplitude on the decent class, to be precise.
No, also the way how do you glue these amplitudes, it's extremely important. These models, it's not just a question of simplex amplitude, as we saw. The way you glue these amplitudes is very important. What are amplitudes? Simplices are associated only, so these simplices are associated in amplitudes, but they're also D minus two simplices, D minus one simplices. They should also be associated some amplitudes.
So
that's what I mean by gluing. You should also specify what are amplitudes for faces of your triangulation where the simplices meet.
That's not what that's meant.
No, I think it's
very important. I'm not saying it's not an important issue. I'm saying that there is one class of theory and what's missing is the expression for the amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody agrees about what the amplitude is. Pick a group and put representations on the D minus one structures and intertwine us on the D minus two structures.
For example, from David's comments, I understood that it's not at all clear that we should restrict ourselves in this model only to simple representations.
No, I agree.
Oh, you're saying just three general class of theories.
Just because it was confusing, there's one class of theories.
Yes.
One class of theories is build a triangulation, take a group,
mm-hmm.
take some of its representations, that's your choice, all or some, and put the representations on certain of the dimensional things, which are one dimension down, and put intertwinements on.
What representations? All possible? Just that's doesn't
choice.
Matter.
Okay, but there's one class of theories, and then there's a list of choices. The list of choices is
infinite dimensional.
Well,
so big.
The list of choices amounts to the specification of the amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
However, just to make clear that there aren't two different things. There aren't two different research programs.
Mm-hmm.
There's
I agree.
A single class.
Yeah. There are just different ways to approach that problem of amplitude. Yeah.
Okay. Let's thank you again.